Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd like to talk about presidents during this hour on this program rather frequently. And our guest this hour wrote a piece in The Atlantic, Happy Birthday, Herbert Hoover, The Lost Legacy of a Hated President. We talk about our nation's 31st president. And as they write, where other presidential birthdays are cause for public holidays or public reflection, this one, which was August 10, likely to pass without notice. He is the president America loves to hate. But there's a story about him that is not as widely known, and that's his great humanitarian efforts. He created the Committee for the Relief of Belgium, and it's a remarkable story. And he also provides perhaps a cautionary tale, as the authors suggest, of what not to do in an economic crisis. We have two guests with us, the authors of the piece in The Atlantic. Jimmy Soney is currently the chief of staff for Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post Media Group. He's the co-author with our other guest, Rob Goodman, of a forthcoming book on Cato the Younger and the Roman Republic. Before joining the Post, he worked in the administration of Mayor Adrian Fenty in Washington, D.C. Rob Goodman, speechwriter in Washington. He's written for publications including the Atlantic.com, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he and Jimmy are co-authors of that forthcoming book that I just mentioned. We'll be welcoming your phone calls about Herbert Hoover. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. And Rob, hello. Thanks.
A lot.
Thank you. So what in the world prompted you to pay attention on his birthday to Herbert Hoover?
Well, there's a wonderful book by a writer, one of my favorite writers, Dan Fromkin, and it's a book called In the Time of the Americans. And what it does is it takes a look at the early 20th century Americans who were responsible for shaping U.S. foreign policy. Mm. And there's two pages, exactly two pages, trapped in the middle of that book, which cover a then little-known mining engineer named Herbert Hoover and this incredible thing that he did when World War I broke out. And I thought the story was fascinating, in part because I had never heard it before. And so as soon as I finished, I just started doing some more digging and realized that in many ways, Hoover shaped how we respond to modern-day crises as a result of his efforts in Belgium.
Mm-hmm. So it set the stage for us. World War I, what happens and what specifically happens to Belgium?
Well, at the start of World War I, Herbert Hoover was a very successful businessman who was living in London at the time. Like Jimmy said, he was a mining engineer. He was a millionaire many times over. People who worked for corporations that were either controlled or owned by Hoover numbered up to 100,000. So he was a very successful American abroad. But he was also really dissatisfied. He was recorded saying to his friends, sometimes I feel like making money isn't enough. He also said there's only so much money a certain guy can make. And once I've made it to the stage of multimillionaire, I'm really interested in getting involved in public service. So he was kind of casting about looking for an opportunity to take some role in public life. And it turns out that at the very time that he's in London, World War One starts. The way that he got dragged in a way, to the relief of Belgium actually started because he was the leader of a relief project to help Americans, including tourists and business people, evacuate from Europe at the start of World War One. It turns out that when war breaks out, people can't access their funds. They have trouble securing transport. People have lost their luggage or congregating in the hundreds and thousands in hotels. And Herbert Hoover actually helps to put together an American committee that secures funding for these Americans trapped overseas and helps get them all on ships back to the United States so that they can escape the war. That was his first real taste of any kind of public life, and it's what began him down the road to being involved in the Belgian crisis.
And talk about how the crisis was created. They just didn't have very much food because food was blocked from entering Belgium.
So Belgium was in an interesting position. It was one of the most industrialized countries in the world, and it imported three-quarters of its food.
Oh, my.
And actually, some estimates have it as high as 5/6, but you know, we'll say three quarters. It turns out that when the German army invaded Belgium, they commandeered whatever food was available. They also made it impossible for farmers to work, so that year's harvest was ruined. So that one quarter of food that Belgium would have been able to produce on its own was gone. The British were blockading the sea, so Belgium could no longer import its food. It could also no longer export the textiles and other things it used to pay for that food. So you have a population of 8 million people with maybe a few weeks of rations left and no guarantee for a harvest this year or next year if the war continued on. And Belgium is basically trapped by, you know, the German army and the British Navy.
And really neither Germany nor the UK is willing to take responsibility for feeding the country at the beginning. The UK insisted as the occupier it's Germany's responsibility to feed the Belgian people. And maybe in a more Machiavellian sense, it thought that if Germany requisitions food in order to keep Belgium from starving, it's going to have less to feed its army. And there's also possibility of food riots, that if Germany has to deal with a food riot in the back of its lines, again, that's going to distract them from the war effort. So both sides really aren't willing to give up food that would be going to their army in order to worry about the civilian population. That's something that helps create a crisis, which wasn't just it wasn't really agricultural at all. It was a politically made crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to give you some sense of the seriousness, at one point, entire towns in Belgium agree to enforce. They basically agree to go to sleep a little after 6:30 p.m. because people are so pained with hunger that the only way to ameliorate that is for them to actually have their children go to bed early so that they have a shorter day and don't have to eat as much.
So Hoover, as you describe it in the article, through sheer force of will, meets with diplomats, he meets with heads of state, he meets with people in America because he gets many, many people to donate an incredible amount of money and thus food.
Right. We found that the budget of the Commission for the Relief of Belgium, which Hoover helped to set up and run, was about $1 billion in 1914 dollars, which translates to something like $21 billion today.
Ooh.
Now, a lot of that was private donations. A lot of it further down the road was subsidies from the American, French, and British governments. But one thing that Hoover was very good at was manipulating the media, getting the word out about this starvation crisis that a lot of Americans at the beginning of the war didn't really know about. Hoover had contacts all over the press, especially in the AP, where he had an old college friend of his. And some historians speculate that Hoover was actually ghostwriting some articles about Belgium that appeared in the AP that helped to get the word out and attract charity support, which is initially what the CRB ran on before it could attract subsidies from the governments involved.
I think the other thing to remember, and the other thing we try to point out in the article, is that he was just utterly relentless. There is a great story about how focused he is on the problem of Belgium. There's a young man he knows from a past life, from his past mining life, who comes to see him in his office. And he walks in to Herbert Hoover's office, and, you know, he walks up to him and he expects to say, you know, hello. And Hoover has his back to the wall, and he's staring at a spot, you know, four or five paces in front of him, and he's looking at this spot, really concentrated on a problem that day. And the young man who's his friend walks up to him and he says, hello, Mr. Hoover, it's great to see you again. And he sticks out his hand, and Hoover doesn't respond. And he doesn't respond for 3-4 minutes. The guy is sort of sitting there awkwardly, you know, nervously pacing, what am I doing? Why isn't he responding to me? Hoover breaks out of that zone, that sort of cone of concentration, and then turns to his friend and says, hello, it's good to see you. But there's story after story like this about how Hoover was just so focused on the problem of the Belgians.
And why is that? Was he remembering being an orphan, or what was it?
Well, I think people speculate on that. I think that was certainly part of it. As you said, he had a very tough childhood. I believe he had lost both his parents by the age of 9 and had a really rough upbringing. So I think that has to be part of it. Also, if you want to be a little more cynical about it, the fact is that he was very interested in becoming involved in public life and understood that this was a way to gain a high profile. But people at the time don't really talk about him as self-publicizing. Whatever his motives might have been, he was much more interested in publicizing the cause and publicizing the great human suffering that was going on in Belgium than really publicizing himself as the man who was helping to get this done. He felt that it was a remarkable display of America's contrast to the old world, but at a time when Europeans were senselessly killing each other, Americans were organizing for this massive benevolent undertaking, which was really the largest humanitarian project in the world to that date.
No, I want you to describe how massive it was, how many people were fed, how much food was brought in.
Sure. It was 9 million Belgians and northern French citizens were being fed. He had 50,000 American volunteers, so little committees of people in the United States who were responsible for pulling together the funds and the food. Another 50,000 European citizens from across Europe, and then countless heads of state, diplomats, you know, security advisors, people. The food was coming in from South America, from Australia, from the United States. I mean, it was an international effort, and he was quite literally the linchpin, flying and doing basically a World War I version of shuttle diplomacy to try to make sure that this food got through.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I caught you in the middle of something too, Rob. Do you remember where your mind was a couple minutes ago?
I think one thing I was going to say that, picking up on what Jimmy said about the scale of this undertaking, that towards the point of American entry in the war, the CRB had just grown by leaps and bounds to the point where one observer, and this is actually my favorite quote about it, described it as a piratical state dedicated to benevolence. So it got to the point at which the CRB had its own flag. Herbert Hoover had informal diplomatic immunity so that he was one of the few people in the world that could really cross any battle lines in the war, whether that was shuttling back and forth from UK to the continent or going between America and the belligerent powers. And of course, America was neutral at the time in the war. So this was basically, he was essentially a mini state that cropped up in response to this emergency. And although it was intended for the short term, by the time Hoover left it around the point of American entry into the war, it had essentially become its own country.
Hmm. Kathleen, you asked a question about kind of what his motives may have been. And
right.
I think, as with any humanitarian mission, even in modern days, Hoover's was probably a mix of idealism and self-interest. He was genuinely moved to tears often by the breadlines, where especially when it came to Belgian children, because he could identify some of those images in his earlier life as an orphan. But then he did want to get into what he called, quote, the big game. You know, I mean, that was his – he really wanted to be a part of something bigger than himself. And I think that's a calling that – it's a calling and a sort of path that you see in a lot of people like him who achieve great financial success and then want to find a way to give back. The other thing that's worth remembering, and it speaks to the kind of idealism part of this, is that – he himself took no salary for 4 years, but in addition, he asked the senior people in the organization, the dozen or so people who helped him launch the CRB, to take no salary. In fact, he would not accept them working for him unless they refused to take a cent, and that's part of what kept the CRB's administrative costs so low, was that he was able to bring people aboard who, because of their personal wealth, were willing to give up salary for a few years.
Before we talk about the legacy and more about the CRB, my mind is, at the moment, trying to imagine how it is somebody who has this kind of identification with Belgian children, who's worried about hunger, can be the same guy who, as you write, refuses to dispense relief, and people are in Hoovervilles and camping out and in deplorable conditions in this country. It's dumbfounding. What happened to the guy?
Well, it's amazing. That's really one of the things that attracted us to the story, and there's really no shortage of theories about how these people can be the same person. One way we look at Herbert Hoover, I think, is really a sort of a tragic figure. And by tragic figure, I mean someone whose greatest success also ended up being one of his greatest flaws. I think his greatest success as a humanitarian showed to him the value of charity, of private enterprise, of disinterested philanthropists doing things for the common good. He was remarkably successful in his previous life as a private philanthropist. He saw the power of private charity and private enterprise to solve problems like this. And I think that affected the way he perceived how problems could be solved down the road. So when the Depression came, it was a problem on an entirely different scale, but he tried to tackle it through methods he developed through the crisis in Belgium and also through his other efforts as a humanitarian trying to do food relief in Europe after the war. We think that shaped how he responded to problems. At the same time, when he was heading the CRB, he also grew extremely frustrated with bureaucracy, with red tape, with governments. I believe a British diplomat said that he found that Herbert Hoover's attitude towards government could be described as kindly get out of my way. There were a number of instances when governments simply refused to accept that this was an important mission that was worth doing, that it didn't distract from the war effort, that it wasn't a distraction or a waste of funds. So I think part of what makes Herbert Hoover into the president he is one, his success, from which he draws maybe some of the wrong lessons, but two, he develops really, I think, a prejudice against the power of government action for good. He sees government as, in a lot of ways, the enemy, because a lot of governments were enemies, or maybe at least frenemies, of the Committee for the Relief of Belgium.
His belief also during the CRB was that people ought to be responsible for their own uplift. So built into the CRB, he made sure that people in Belgium who could pay were paying for their food. And that was a big principle that he believed in. And he also, when the Great Depression hits the country, he does believe that too much government intervention would take away Americans' ability to be responsible for their own care, for their own lives.
We're going to welcome phone calls and hear more about Herbert Hoover, who celebrated his birthday. We're into celebrations of birthdays these days, too. Last week it was Lucille Ball. Today it's Herbert Hoover, who celebrated his birthday on August 10, and prompted the guest this hour to write a very interesting piece titled "Happy Birthday, Herbert Hoover, The Lost Legacy of a Hated President." Jimmy Soney and Rob Goodman are the authors of the piece appearing in The Atlantic. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. A reminder, tomorrow night at 8, special election night coverage on the Ideas Network. Our reporter Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager are going to be, holding the fort here, talking with analysts and reporters around the state about the results of Tuesday's recall elections. And they're always on top of the numbers, too, so you know where the votes are coming from. They did a great job last week, and they will be with you again tomorrow night at 8. Democratic seats they're trying to retain. And so tune in to find out what happens. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To join this conversation, again, it's 800-486-8655. Bill is our first caller somewhere on the road. Hi, Bill.
Hi. The question I have is, in the article, do they talk at all about Herbert Hoover's involvement with the 1927 Mississippi flood and the relief catastrophe that took place there, where a lot of the sharecropping farmers were kept somewhat captive in camps? Or am I totally mistaken about Hoover's involvement with that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Bill. Thank you.
No, thanks. I think that's a good question. Now, our article really covered Hoover's time in Belgium, but I think it's important, as the caller pointed out, that he did have a career that extended past that in food and disaster relief. After World War One, Hoover was what was informally known as the food dictator of Europe. He was in charge of all post-war food distribution for Europe. He played a huge role in feeding the USSR during its civil war in the 1920s. But as the caller pointed out, in 1927, when Hoover was Commerce Secretary, he led a lot of the relief efforts for a huge historic flood of the Mississippi River. I think the role of race and African-American sharecroppers in that incident is something that historians still dispute. I think on the one hand, it was a well-run instance of disaster relief. But on the other hand, there's some speculation that Hoover actually suppressed the information on how negative the conditions were for African-American sharecroppers. And some people who were political opponents of Hoover at the time suggested that he wasn't really honest about the degree of suffering that was going on, and the degree of how disproportionately the flooding in the Mississippi impacted sharecroppers because he wanted to keep negative information from his role in disaster relief from getting out into the upcoming presidential campaign, which he ran in 1928. So I think there's certainly dispute about whether Hoover's political ambitions by that point clouded his role as administrator of disaster relief. I think that's a good question.
Yeah, thank you. Was he presented as a great humanitarian? Was his work in Belgium highlighted in that 1928 presidential campaign?
It absolutely was. One source that we found that was interesting was Walter Lippmann, who was a journalist at the time who was opposed to Hoover. What he said was that Hoover had essentially been the best sold, best marketed, best packaged American politician since Teddy Roosevelt. He said, and I'm quoting here, that before his nomination, a great majority of the electorate were thoroughly psychologized into the conviction that Hoover was almost a Superman. Hoover was described as the great engineer, the great humanitarian. And there was some concern, especially when you contrast his behavior in the private sector as humanitarian with his behavior as president, that Hoover had been really oversold, that the degree of his organizational genius that had been presented to the public really didn't match up to the reality they saw when he was confronted with the crisis of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the case that the 1928 campaign and however he was presented would look markedly different from anything we know about today. You know, the basic sum total of the public campaigning he did, he made seven or so radio speeches to the nation where he didn't even mention his opponent by name. And then the one place where his humanitarian efforts were clearly on display were in a campaign film he made. It was called Herbert Hoover, Master of Emergencies. And according to what we know, audiences actually left the theater in tears because, and
oh,
we got a copy of this online. And what you see are long lines of people, standing outside of locations where they're going to get food that was contributed by the Americans. There's big American flags everywhere, and it made him out to be this humanitarian. And he really managed actually to combine that. He managed to combine kind of the humanitarian piece of his biography with the piece that said, I'm an engineer, I'm an administrator, I'm a problem solver. And so he, in some ways, he's this compassionate technocrat. And that was his image when he ran in 1928.
I think today we might call him postpartisan. That's part of the way that he packages himself as a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
It was also, by the way, the interesting thing about that campaign is where the Republicans launched the now sort of famous slogan, a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage.
Right. Yeah. There were some important things that happened as a result of the work that he did and who he was. You mentioned programs like the Peace Corps, USAID, disaster relief, and also just individually his being a forerunner of people like Bill Gates. Can you elaborate?
Well, I think one thing that's a direct line between Hoover and later relief programs that go on is that a lot of programs that crop up in the second half of the 20th century were staffed by veterans of the Committee for the Relief of Belgium. Things like UNICEF is actually, in some senses, a direct descendant of the CRB.
Hmm.
But I think in the broader sense, programs like USAID, Peace Corps, just in general, the expectation that when there's a worldwide disaster, Americans are going to be there, are all, in a sense, really descendants of the attitude that Hoover helped to create in response to the Belgian crisis. America had never really been involved in relief of this scale. But one of his most important jobs was selling Americans on the idea of involvement abroad. In a way, it actually helped pave the way for American entrance into the war because it helped paint a picture of suffering among civilian populations that were created by the belligerent powers. It helped create the idea of America as the idealistic country that intervened abroad to set right human rights crises.
Herbert Hoover was he was tasked with several presidents after his own presidency to continue this kind of work. So in 1939, he's asked to run the Commission for Polish Relief, which was necessary after Adolf Hitler invaded Poland. he's asked by Truman to run what's called the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. So very similar work, again, to provide technical expertise, medical supplies, construction equipment, that kind of thing. And then Hoover is actually directly responsible for the creation of UNICEF. And much of the early days of UNICEF look a lot like the early days of the Committee on the Relief of Belgium. The structure, the function, it's very much the same.
Fascinating. And did he convince a lot of other very, very wealthy people that making money isn't enough and they should do something else or they should part with some of their money?
Well, he certainly helped to spearhead a campaign that won American dollars to help feed the Belgians. And that was, like I said, a really well-organized publicity campaign by Hoover and by his friends in the press. He also had people on the staff, like Jimmy pointed out, that were fellow wealthy industrialists. But I think part of the issue is that when he became president during the Depression, he also tried to rely on the spirit of voluntarism, whether it was encouraging large banks to form a consortium to lend to smaller banks, or whether it was encouraging other business leaders simply just not to lay off their workers. He had learned from his experience as a humanitarian that voluntarism works, that private sector charity works, that minimizing and streamlining government bureaucracies works. But the problem is he met a scale of crisis in the Depression that his previous experience just didn't match up to. Mm-hmm. You might have said in 1928, if there was anyone in the world who was capable of dealing with an economic crisis of this scale, it would have been Herbert Hoover.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I think it's true, and I think that's how people viewed him as the great engineer and the great humanitarian. But it turned out that he simply wasn't up to the task.
It actually also, what's fascinating about the early days of the CRB is how much competition there is to get involved in the relief game. The early history of his efforts in Belgium is it's about political rivalry, and it's about public acclaim, and it's about who can claim credit for what. He actually competes with a rival mining engineer who's trying to use the Rockefeller Foundation to create his own relief effort based out of New York. And Hoover just has to fight tooth and nail. He has to write scathing New York Times editorials to make to let the public know that he got there first and that it's actually that he's running an effort already and that we can't have duplicative efforts because it'll ultimately lead to a lot of inefficiency. And so what's interesting is, Hoover and some of his contemporaries had this sense of noblesse oblige that they had to participate, but it actually ultimately makes for some very interesting history because they're fighting over their right to help the Belgian people.
Hmm. Are there statues and great thanks still given to Hoover in Belgium?
There's actually, I think it's in the city of Leuven, there's a Hoover Plein, which is Hoover Square. I think there's also a Hoover Day and Hoover Parades. We've seen a few stories of American tourists who have gone over to Belgium and been shocked that this Herbert Hoover guy, who was absolutely reviled over here,
yes,
is still in some sense a hero over there.
Yeah, and understandably so.
Also, at the end of the CRB, there was, I don't remember the exact sum of money, but there was a fairly decent sum of money left in the CRB's coffers. And some people argued, well, you ought to just return that money to the donors and go from there. And Hoover pointed out that, the rebuilding was not yet done. So he used the money to help construct libraries and universities around Belgium.
My.
So you'll often see, we found photos of plaques that bear Hoover's name that are on big libraries, these beautiful old buildings.
Huh.
And they all bear the name Herbert Hoover because it was because of the committee's funding that those places were able to be established.
Yeah, isn't it? The whole thing, it's just hard to put the guy together, isn't it? What happened subsequently, it's just hard to make sense of all of it.
It really is. Lippmann actually says that some people wondered if Hoover had some sort of split personality. They couldn't reconcile the person who was an extremely rigid and in some sense a reactionary president who railed against the New Deal, socialism, big government, with this extremely successful humanitarian. But I think what we're trying to point out is that there's a lot of continuity between the two versions of this man, that in a way his success in Belgium kind of helped to create a tragic flaw, the sense that the methods that worked there simply weren't adaptable to the economic crisis of the Depression.
In his own time, too, people kind of saw him as this contradiction. His wife once said, if you ever want the least optimistic view on a situation, just ask my husband. And so he is this interesting, incredibly enigmatic figure. He's very, very quiet with his staff. There's a story, multiple stories, multiple reports about how he'll take long car rides, 80-kilometer car rides across Belgium, and he won't say one word to the people who are riding with him. I mean, these rides happen in silence because he's just so swept up in his own kind of intellect. And at the same time, he is, you know, he is moved to tears when he's with children. He is able to sort of empathize. It's an incredible situation because you have this guy who is a very effective administrator and somebody who's incredibly successful, and he's also deeply empathetic. But then when it comes to the Depression, he's not able to combine those two things in the same way. And part of that, and Rob may be able to speak to this more, but he also, to some extent, has a political tin ear. So when he gets into office in the presidency, he launches a number of executive commissions and executive studies to look at various social problems, poverty, education. And those commissions are well-oiled machines. They write great reports. They do brilliant statistical analysis. They bring him everything, you know, on time and under budget and in exactly the way he would like. But what he's not able to do is manage Congress. So Congress, he just simply cannot square the factions within his own party, let alone with the Democratic Party.
Mm. And Hoover, up to the point that he became president, like Jimmy said, was usually surrounded by people who were, in some senses, in awe of him. I mean, in the first case, he was a business executive, and that's a case where you really have absolute power. In the case of the Committee for the Relief of Belgium, here's a man who is surrounded by people who are so in awe of his success as a humanitarian, who refer to him as the chief, who really take his word as law within this piratical government organized for benevolence, as an observer called it. So you have Herbert Hoover as an example of someone who gets to this highest point of his career in politics and yet doesn't really know how to cope with a situation in which his word is no longer law. And that's really, even though he was never involved in the military, that's something that military men who get involved in politics often run into. It's the contrast and the disconnect between having absolute control and being surrounded by people who listen to you and don't put up a fight, right, being surrounded by people who have their own political agendas. I know you mentioned in the intro that we're working on a book about Cato and the Roman Republic, and one person that really strikes us as similar to Herbert Hoover is the General Pompey, who was Julius Caesar's nemesis. And Pompey was an extremely successful organizer. He was remarkably charismatic. He was, until Caesar, he was the most successful general of his time. And yet when he got into politics, he simply found that he wasn't listened to in the same way that he was listened to as a general. And this proved enormously frustrating for him, and it really helped spell his failure in politics. I think a lot of people had trouble making that transition, and Hoover was really one of them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to more phone calls. Tim in Colorado. Hi.
Hi. I want to thank you for the guests. And you guys gave me an excuse for something to do when I go back home. My dad built the presidential library for Herbert Hoover in
My goodness.
Wow.
That's great you're calling in.
I can remember, you know, going through some old slides when I was trying to go through the old family slides showing the limousines carrying Truman and maybe Eisenhower, I'm not quite sure, and et cetera, et cetera, and Dad talking about it. And it was one of the prouder things he ever did, even though, he kind of took it on as a job that he wanted to do just for the prestige part of it. And it was really interesting to see the graphics, and I'm thinking 30 years back or more now since I've been there, but the Hoover Library, at least at that time period, 30, 40 years ago, was all about what you're talking about, the food for relief programs, and not much about his presidential.
Yeah, I'd want to downplay that, too.
It was interesting. I have a question for you also. When I'm listening to you, I'm hearing the Republican mantra that they say today. You know, they pull yourself up by the bootstraps, we can do this with private charity, et cetera, versus the same, you know, and then FDR came in and they used government to help people out rather than the private organizations. And I'm wondering, did it all start here or not, or do you know?
So I think it's a persistent sort of question within American life, right? And it extends basically as far back as Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, those debates or versions of those debates. For Herbert Hoover, his financial success came entirely from the private sector, and he had this real faith in the ability of the private sector to help people. That said, he wasn't sort of anti-regulatory. When he was Secretary of Commerce, he actually ushered in regulations in radio and in telephone communications. He also believed that there were huge inefficiencies in the economy, and that part of the role of government was to kind of smooth out bubbles and to make sure that you didn't have too much of an ebb and flow, so that you didn't have so much social dislocation. And a lot of what his early work in the presidency were just kind of committee and commission reports to study those sorts of problems. That said, when the Depression hits, he is naturally, sort of has a natural reluctance to have government intervene in the form of direct relief to people. What he does is focuses on kind of helping strengthen corporations, helping make sure big banks are able to help smaller banks. He impresses upon his fellow business leaders that, they shouldn't lay people off. But all of that, at a certain point, is just too little, too late.
Hmm. What did your dad think of Hoover, Tim?
He didn't say much about it. He was just really proud of building the library. But he's, 86 years old and never gets out of the house anymore. And now I have an excuse when I go back to try to drag him out and drag him back to the library.
Oh, yes, by all means. Yes, you should.
That's great. I was going to say that up to the point that Hoover becomes president, he's really on the record with a lot of progressive instincts. So one thing he said, I think this is in the 20s, was that the founding fathers wanted America to be a classless country. And by classless, he didn't mean there would be disparities of wealth, but that there would be absolute equality of opportunity. So that if anyone had the ambition and the motive to pursue social mobility, they could make it to the top of the economic system, and much as he did. I think part of the problem is that when he became president, he was really blind to the ways in which inequality had taken hold to a scale that he never really imagined, and in the ways in which government can help create equality of opportunity. He really considered the New Deal a road much too far. He considered it socialism, and really he thought it would represent the decay of the American values of independence and gumption and pull yourself up by your bootstraps that we talked about. So actually, after he lost and lost decisively the 1932 election to Roosevelt, he sort of mounted a private campaign to convince Roosevelt to abandon the New Deal. A lot of historians have called this the most acrimonious, most awkward presidential transition in history, because it was stretched out over 4 months. This was before the date of the inauguration was moved to January. So there was a long period in which Hoover was a lame duck and essentially trying to persuade Roosevelt that the New Deal would mean the death of these American values that helped make social mobility possible. And, of course, Roosevelt was having none of this because he saw that the policies adopted by Hoover weren't really working to alleviate the Depression. So there's a sense in which Hoover really, he had an ideological commitment to small government, to private enterprise, to philanthropy. But I think, on the other hand, you can say that he came about it honestly because of the success that he had in those realms before he became president. So it's not as if he arrived at these things abstractly. He had a lot of reason to believe that he was right.
Mm-hmm.
It just turned out that it wasn't borne out by events when he made it to the summit of his career.
Thank you, Tim. Let's go to Matt in Viroqua next. Hi, Matt.
Hi. My first job as a young law enforcement park ranger in 1994 was at Herbert Hoover National Historic Site. And just a few years before I started working there, they still had 24-hour guard on the grave sites of Hoover and his wife. I ran into numerous visitors that came to the park that were still people that lived through the Depression that just reviled him and were angry that there was a site for him. And what I'm wondering is, the Democratic presidents that appointed him to these later relief positions, did they face any public backlash from people that they had appointed this man who was held responsible by many to be at fault for the Great Depression suffering?
Well, it is the case that after the presidency, he basically goes dark for a while. He retreats to his home in Palo Alto, and he just kind of stays out of public life. The Republicans want him to become involved in party politics, but he ends up not doing so. he's actually kind of rehabilitated in some ways because people recognize that he was somebody who had a great deal of expertise when it came to disaster relief and organizational skills and humanitarian aid, that kind of thing. And so he does, it's actually FDR who supports his appointment to be the chair of a relief organization, that Polish relief organization. And so, you know, even though, you know, their transition ended about as badly as it could go, FDR actually initially supports him for this. And then, you know, Truman makes him the coordinator of food supply for world famine. And I don't know that they faced backlash, and I think that's partly because Hoover's humanitarian work was unimpeachable. I mean, he really had succeeded. And so yeah, I think that the belief was, well, if we keep him on what he knows and what he does well, rather than running the country, maybe we'll be okay. The other thing, though, is that there is a fairly bitter public debate in Congress over the naming of the Hoover Dam. And so at one point, there is a congressional fight over that, and he almost loses the name.
And the extent, you mentioned the extent, albeit in a short couple sentences, but it makes you want to know more of the hatred for him. In Wisconsin, a man was caught pulling up railroad spikes ahead of the Hoover Express.
That's true. And actually, I think in Nevada, a man was caught approaching the Hoover Express with two sticks of dynamite trying to sabotage the train tracks. So certainly by the 1932 election, he was treated as the national scapegoat for the Depression. He was treated as the man responsible. And part of the reason the campaign went so poorly is almost on principle. Hoover didn't really change the way he campaigned. I think Jimmy described that during the 1928 election, he was a man of very few words. He gave just a small number of radio addresses. In 1932, that didn't change. He tried to make public appearances, but he didn't really play to crowds. He was a miserable public speaker. He essentially read from a typed sheet of paper without making eye contact. So if he was being scapegoated for this depression, he certainly wasn't the kind of skilled politician and experienced politician to be able to place the blame anywhere else, to be able to get any remainder of goodwill from the American people. So he was pelted with vegetables. He was pelted with rotten eggs. And like we said, a number of times people tried to sabotage his train. And the really interesting thing is that in some sense, Hoover predicted this was going to happen. We dug up this really interesting quote from him, and this is before he was inaugurated in 1928, after he won the presidency, but before he took power. And he said, "If some unexpected calamity should come upon the nation, I should be sacrificed to the unreasoning disappointment of a people who expected too much." That's just remarkably prescient, because that turned out to be exactly what happened. People expected him to use his expertise in relief to relieve the Great Depression. When that didn't happen, people turned on him as they have turned on few presidents in history.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Thank you, Matt, very much for your call. We're talking about Herbert Hoover this hour of the program. We have two guests with us who have written a very interesting piece in The Atlantic on the occasion of his birthday, but it looks at his humanitarian work, how dissatisfied we were with him, and we have yet to move on, and we will, to a conversation about what is the cautionary tale that we need to be told from this time period. Our guests are Jimmy Soney, Chief of Staff for Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post Media Group, Rob Goodman, speechwriter in Washington, D.C. Both gentlemen are working on a forthcoming book on Cato the Younger and the Roman Republic. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gentlemen, let's spend a few minutes talking about what the cautionary tale is we need to be reminded of, and this brings some of it up, an email from Mary. In regard to the tragedy of Hoover, I'm reminded of President Obama, who met a serious condition in the economy, the financial meltdown, which resulted in many Americans losing their homes and jobs. The mid-year election, where he has a Republican majority which doesn't allow him to do anything to change these conditions, the 2014 election will tell the tale of whether he will or can be rightfully compared to Hoover.
Well, I think it might be a bit premature to say whether or not he could be compared to Hoover. I mean, we're looking at Hoover with the benefit of a lot of hindsight. The debate still rages to this day between economists and historians and political scientists about the exact causes of the Great Depression. There is an argument that says that Hoover was simply swept up in the tide of events, and events that were well beyond the president, the control of the President of the United States. He during his administration, harped on the theme that, look, this is an international financial crisis as much as it is a domestic crisis, and you need to recognize that and cut us some slack. We're doing as much as we can. I think the cautionary tale comes out in the Committee on the Relief of Belgium was a private effort. It was one citizen of a neutral country helping a belligerent country by raising private aid with a mix of public dollars and then administering it using, you know, a committee that was basically private employees, many of whom were unpaid. In the face of that and the lessons that Hoover drew from that, he seems not to have responded to the Depression, at least the sort of human suffering in the Depression, with the same kind of urgency. He never authorizes the sort of large-scale relief programs that people would like. He seems unwilling to use significant government intervention in the economy, at least in the early days of the crisis. And to some extent, I think you can make a kind of direct connection between the experiences that he has with government during his creation of the Committee on the Relief of Belgium and the unwillingness or the hesitation to have government intervene in a large-scale way during the Great Depression. And I think, you know, this is like Rob said, it's classically tragic. The man's successes laid the seeds of his failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that on a personal level, it's really a lesson about ambition. I think if Hoover had stopped and he was ahead in the sense in which, at a point in which, according to a lot of people, Hoover had saved more lives than any people we know of in history, if he'd stopped at that point, he'd be remembered as one of the great figures ever to come on the scene, internationally or American. Unfortunately, he pressed ahead. He became involved in things for which he really wasn't prepared or qualified. And partly as a result of that, he has a truly mixed legacy, but a legacy in which the good parts have been forgotten and almost entirely overshadowed by the bad. Mm. So in a sense, he really should have stopped when he was ahead.
The other thing is that fate almost did stop him. He took when he was leaving Europe for the final time to come back to America after the committee had been handed over to the Dutch and to the French, he's on a ship called the SS Philadelphia. And the ship is delayed by a few days. They notice that there might be German U-boats in the water. They finally leave, and when they leave, at one point during the journey, the ship makes a really hard lurch to the right, and they find out later that the ship missed a pair of mines by about 40, 50 feet.
Hmm.
And so we almost, fate almost had dealt its own hand to Herbert Hoover.
Right. Let's go to Ted next. Hi, Ted.
Hi. I'm just curious how it is possible that Hoover did not learn from some of the famous people he was associated with, other presidents he worked with. I mean, he was with Coolidge, was really the first to use the radio and newsreels and understood the power of communicating effectively with people, even though he didn't have the voice that Harding had, you know, the guy who died and made Coolidge president. I mean, Harding had these farm relief bills when things were actually quite a bit better than later, you know, 20 years later in the Depression. He had this biggest economic recovery, you know, thing going after World War One. Harding was this just strong, captivating public speaker, and Hoover was actually one of the guys who sat and helped Harding write some of these speeches. After being associated with Harding and Coolidge, how could Hoover be this kind of weak public speaker who wouldn't even connect with people's eyes? And, you know, how is that possible that he couldn't learn from his previous experiences being such a genius, you know?
Yeah, thank you, Ted, for the question.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think part of it is that a lot of people testified to the fact that Hoover was just naturally shy. He was known for not making eye contact, for looking away from people, even in conversation. His enemies really said that was just an example of his shiftiness and his calculation, and more friendly people said he was just socially awkward. So part of it, he didn't really have the natural talent of someone like a Harding or even Calvin Coolidge, who, of course, had this reputation of Silent Cal, but was still able to create a really strong public persona that really covered up his weaknesses. The other part of it is, like we said, I think although Hoover was very good at manipulating the press from a distance and getting out an extraordinary publicity campaign about his success as an organizer and the success of the CRB, he also felt
in a way that by sticking to the earlier traditions of a president who wasn't extraordinarily involved in his campaign or his reelection campaign, he was standing on principle. He wasn't changing with events. One thing that FDR is really famous for is for being, I believe, the first president to fly to the convention and accept the nomination in person. At the time, that was really a revolutionary thing when campaigns are still kind of in the old front porch tradition, the idea that the candidate doesn't get out and make a huge stir and people campaign on his behalf. Now, by the 32 election, that tradition was kind of falling away, but Hoover still felt it was, in a sense, an important thing to stick to. So he was really outclassed in the publicity department when it came to the campaign by FDR, who was really willing to take the candidate's approach to publicity and to really seizing the limelight in a way that no previous candidate had done to extremes. Hoover never really competed in that, and I think part of the reason is he thought that the method of campaigning that worked for him on his record in 1928 was just as good as 1932, and he really didn't need to make a lot of adjustments, and that turned out to be a mistake.
And on that note, we have to end because we're totally out of time. Gentlemen, I think you have more than enough material here to just do a book on Hoover now, so why not, huh?
Well, we'll consider it.
I think you should. Thank you both so much. It was really an interesting hour. And we direct our listeners to The Atlantic. Happy birthday, Herbert Hoover, the lost legacy of a hated president. Our guest, Jimmy Soney, chief of staff for Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Media Group, Rob Goodman, speechwriter in Washington, D.C. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. A reminder, we will provide election coverage, two more recall elections tomorrow starting at 8 o'clock. It's good coverage here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.